Welcome from Pacifica Radio. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan. This week, we'll get an update on the political turmoil in Lebanon from Ziad Abu Rish, a visiting associate professor of human rights at Bard College. Later in the program, we speak with Tara Seperifar, Iran researcher for Human Rights Watch, about the prominent Iranian human rights lawyer Nasrin Sotoudeh, who's been on a hunger strike since August 11th, protesting conditions of Iran prisons amid the pandemic. Stay with us. More than 5 weeks have passed since a massive explosion ripped through Beirut, killing more than 200 people, wounding at least 6,500, and leaving nearly 300,000 people homeless. This week, we go back to Beirut to speak with Professor Ziad Abu Rish about the political developments in the country since that devastating blast on August 4th. Shahram Aghamir started by asking Professor Abu Rish about how Beirut and its population have been faring during this crisis and what has been done to address the basic and urgent needs of the population who have been greatly impacted by the massive explosion.
I think we would have to talk on two different levels. One is the level of the government response, and then is the level of the non-governmental response. And by that, I don't just mean NGOs, but I also just mean individuals and more informal collectives. I think it's fair to say that overall, the government response has been largely lacking, both in terms of providing immediate assistance and aid to those that have been affected, as you enumerated with terms of the statistics of the dead, the injured, the homeless, and we shouldn't forget the missing. And of course, that's to say nothing of the fact that despite the government promising a swift investigation, there has been no formal announcement on the status of the investigation, its findings thus far, and most of what we know about the causes and background to the explosion has largely been the result of the investigative work of local journalists, supplemented every once in a while by leaks from different parts of the state apparatus, which, while providing important information, these leaks seem more focused on trying to redirect public attention to different political parties or different state institutions rather than providing any transparent and accountable rendering of what exactly happened and what allowed for it in terms of the explosion. Moving beyond the government response, some of the most immediate surrounding neighborhoods of the port have been vastly devastated. And most efforts at, first of all, taking stock of the damage, displacement, injury, and death has largely been a function of personal or private initiatives in the form of ad hoc formations of Lebanese and other individuals, as well as some of the activist groups, and then some of the mainstay of the NGO sector in Lebanon. I think it's fair to say that almost a month after the explosion, people remain deeply traumatized. Those that have been made dependent on aid for housing, shelter, food, and medicine continue to be so. And most people are left without answers as to why this exactly happened and who allowed it to happen and who should be held accountable. Earlier this week, there was a major attempt at trying to identify what appeared to be a survivor in the rubbles of one of the port surrounding neighborhoods. This was led by a Chilean rescue team. And while at the end of the search effort, it was revealed that there was no one under the rubble, 3 days of the attempt to survey, remove the debris, and maintain a kind of safe and secure environment in which the rescue operation could be carried out was repeatedly obstructed, intervened in, or otherwise undermined by the Lebanese army and other aspects of the Lebanese state. And I think that scene and the footage and video and testimonials really laid bare that we still have people missing. We still have not properly surveyed and removed the debris from the destruction of the explosion, and that people were much more willing and ready, as they should be, to trust the Chilean volunteer team in its search and rescue efforts than they were the statements of the Lebanese army or other government officials.
On September 1st, Lebanon's ruling bloc designated a new prime minister for the second time in 8 months, following former Prime Minister Hassan Diab's resignation shortly after the massive explosion in Beirut. Mustafa Adib has been appointed to form a new government following a consensus among the ruling parties. Although former Prime Minister Saad Hariri proposed his name, Mr. Adib is close to another ex-premier, multi-billionaire Najib Mighati, and has been serving as Lebanon's ambassador to Germany for the past 7 years. What do we know about Mr. Adib, and what is the word on the streets about him? Is he considered another figure from the political establishment, or is there some significance attached to his designation?
I think that's a great question, Shahram. And I think the answer points to the fact that as far as the political class in Lebanon and the primary politicians and political parties that are in charge of the different government apparatuses, they are continuing as business as usual. I would think of Mustafa Adib as another Hassan Diab, someone who is, for all intents and purposes, a relative newcomer to the premiership and to centers of power in Lebanon. On the other hand, he is someone that was the consensus pick of a number of the political parties, and therefore, I believe, should be viewed wearily as someone who they believe that they can either control or directly undermine should he attempt to pursue an independent course of action. I think it's important to recognize that if we are talking about the street in the sense of the mainstay of activist groups and groups that organized protests in the October 17th uprising, and since then, that Mustafa Adib is viewed as illegitimately and as a front cover for the existing political parties, as was Hassan Diab. And we should note that Mustafa Adib was the consensus pick of all the former prime ministers, meaning Rafiq Hariri, Najib Mighati, Fuad Senora, and Tamam Islam, collectively nominated Mustafa Adib for the premiership. And then he subsequently, at least publicly, received the support of other groups and individuals that were part of the formal consultations with the president of Lebanon for the designation of a new prime minister. So,
including 105 MPs, as has been reported.
Yes, exactly. So there is no reason to suspect that he represents anything new. He is simply a new attempt at developing a new government that can oversee the next phase. One reporter at one point described Mustafa Adib as the counterpoint to Hassan Diab. So whereas Hassan Diab was viewed as a March 8th pick for the political class in the formation of a government that was supposedly to represent some kind of break or new faces with respect to the musical chairs that happens in the formation of cabinets, Mustafa Adib is viewed as the counterpart to Hassan Diab, meaning he is someone that is not necessarily the direct pick of March 8th, but those groups that in one way or another might have formed March 14th, the other primary political coalition in Lebanon. But at the end of the day, he has secured the support and agreement of political groups and leaders across that March 8th and March 14th, which brings us back to the question of a political class that is maneuvering to maintain its hold on power in the face of an uprising that has all but fizzled out for now, and multiple and overlapping crises that have caused a severe legitimacy crisis on the part of this political class, but also a severe crisis in its ability to generate and secure foreign funding, which it desperately needs in these times of economic crisis.
Ziad, quite a few political parties and international actors have proposed the formation of a national unity government that would include members of all major political factions as a way out of the gridlock. Without knowing much about the political landscape in Lebanon and the political structure in that country, that sounds like a benign idea. But you are critical of such proposal in the Lebanese context. Can you explain to us why?
My criticism of such a proposal shares with the criticism of many activists and analysts who know Lebanon far better than I do. I think it's important to understand that what's being proposed is what's called a national unity government, in the sense that no major political party will be excluded from government and that all major political parties will be included. And not just the process of forming this government, but will actually have one form of representation or another on this government. This brings us back to square one of the problem in the Lebanese context, which is that the political class itself has led Lebanon to the current set of multiple and overlapping crises, whether it's about development, whether it's about the state budget, whether it's about the currency depreciating, whether it's about COVID-19 or the Beirut explosion of August 4th. So the idea that if we can just get these political parties to agree to form a government, then we will solve the problem in Lebanon, ignores the fact that it is actually the agreement and collusion of these political parties that has led Lebanon to the current status quo, and that any way out of the current status quo needs to bypass or at least somewhat render this political class, this broad constellation of political parties and politicians, sidelined in the process of exiting from this crisis. When people talking about national unity government, they are taking into account what we can call the traditional political parties, or basically the political parties that were able to transition themselves from militias during the Civil War into political parties with relatively similar positions in the post-war order. So I think it's important to realize that when people say national unity government, they don't mean they're bringing together the liberals, the conservatives, the leftists in terms of these political persuasions. They mean the existing political parties. And when they say national unity government, they're not really talking about bringing to the fore and empowering some of the grassroots organizations and leaders in the new government. Again, they are talking about national unity within the framework of the existing dominant political parties at the expense and exclusion of the dominant forces demanding transparency, accountability, and social justice in Lebanon.
There is also this idea of holding early parliamentary elections as a solution to the current crises. Remind us why you think that approach will only reproduce the current power structure in Lebanon.
I think the best way to think about it is to simply acknowledge that elections are not popularity contests. Elections are contests between different coalitions and organizations that have resources or lack resources in their attempt to actually mobilize voters. And they do so within a set of rules and regulations that govern what is possible and not possible in running candidates and in mobilizing voters. So basically, there is no reason to suspect that holding early parliamentary elections would result in a parliament that is fundamentally different in its composition than the current parliament. And this is because the rules governing parliamentary elections in Lebanon are designed in such a way to favor the existing status quo political parties and to exclude independent challengers to the existing incumbents. I think this is very important. Also, I think if you're going to hold elections, you need to allow time for these independent groups that choose to participate in elections to generate the resources necessary and craft the strategy and wage an electoral campaign based on that. Again, if you jump straight into early parliamentary elections, those parties that have run in parliamentary elections time and time again are going to be the ones that are best suited to compete and win seats. And this goes back to the point that despite the October 17th uprising, we know that electoral behavior does not necessarily correspond to what we can call public popularity polls. Electoral behavior is largely shaped by the rules and regulations governing the elections and the resources and capacities of different groups running in the elections. So for elections to be meaningful, there is going to need to be what's called a fundamentally different electoral law. Activists and progressives and analysts critical of the status quo have long advocated for a very particular set of reforms to the electoral law, meaning the law that governs the organization of elections, in order for it to reflect the actual will of the people, as opposed to reflect the balance of power between existing established political parties and any potential challenger.
Can you give us a sort of brief bullet point on these electoral laws in Lebanon, including the issues of gerrymandering and absence of provisions for proportional representation and so forth and so on?
I think you've pointed out to some of them, Shahram. I mean, the first thing is to remember that nothing in the Constitution actually mandates that parliamentary seats be perpetually divided along sectarian quotas, right? So the very fact of designating a certain number of seats as reserved for Sunni candidates or Shia candidates or Druze candidates or Maronite candidates or Armenian candidates or any kind of sectarian defined quota is primarily a function of the electoral law. How many electoral districts the country is divided into, what are the boundaries of those electoral districts, and what are the number of seats given to these electoral districts is itself a function of the electoral law. And we know that how big or small an electoral district is can have an important effect on the ability of those two challenging status quo parties to wage a successful campaign or not. There are other more minor issues, and by minor I mean that don't immediately draw one's attention, such as, for example, the financial burden of registering your campaign and the costs of being able to run in the elections, apart from the costs a candidate might spend in terms of political advertising or events. I'm talking about the cost of registering as a candidate is exorbitantly high and usually requires some kind of financial backing. So that's one element. The other element, of course, is where are the polling centers? What are the rules governing how candidates are represented during the counting process? What kind of ballots are used? These are all issues that really matter in the establishment of parliamentary or any other elections. Of course, then there's the issue of the percentage threshold and the lack of proportional representation. So all of these issues have long been criticized by people seeking a meaningful change in the electoral system in Lebanon. Unless all of those issues are addressed in a manner that tries to make elections more reflective of actual voting behavior, you're going to end up with this problem. And I'll simply end with one very crucial issue with regards to elections in Lebanon. Most people, when it comes to elections, have to vote in their town or district of registration, which is usually a function of where they or their fathers were born. It is not a function of where they live. So, for example, the majority of Beirut's population would not be able to cast a vote for the parliamentarians representing the Beirut districts. They would have to go and return to their home districts, meaning districts in which they were born in or their fathers were born in and therefore they are registered in, because it is extremely difficult to change your voter registration from your family town of origin to your place of residence. And this is something, of course, we saw in the 2016 municipal elections, but it will come back and repeat itself, of course, in the 2018 parliamentary elections and then in whatever parliamentary elections might be held now. So all of these issues are important to be addressed before elections can be held. Otherwise, once again, there is no reason to assume that the existing status quo forces will not simply be voted back into office.
You had an excellent piece in Merib about the 2016 local elections in Lebanon, in which you really dissect these electoral laws in Lebanon. I really encourage people who want to know more about it to read that piece on Merib.org. You write, and I quote, "Lebanon's many pressing and overlapping crises today require an independent government made up of competent women and men who share a common vision for leading the country forward. To be effective, this government must also be endowed with legislative powers." The end of quote. You add that Lebanon experienced 7 governments with legislative authority in different timelines between 1952 and 1988. Can you elaborate on this notion of independent government with legislative authority? Also, why do you think such a government would be a viable alternative in today's Lebanon? Is it even doable?
Thank you for that quote and the question. And I believe you're referring to an article that I co-authored with 3 other colleagues at the Lebanese Center for Policy Studies.
Yes.
I think what we're proposing here, and here now I'll switch to speaking for myself, because while the article was written by us, I don't want to speak for the other co-authors. Assuming we are thinking about some kind of meaningful change in Lebanon through the existing constitutional framework, as opposed to some kind of mass revolution that will overthrow the existing political system and devise some mechanism to craft a new constitution, we have to work within the existing structures. And the existing structures is that a cabinet will have to be formed, and that cabinet will eventually have to propose legislation that the parliament will have to adopt. Because in Lebanon, the primary locus of legislation, or the highest form of any kind of government legislation that can happen, is a law. And it is parliament that passes laws, as opposed to cabinets that can pass decrees or orders, if you will. So you need a law. For example, it is an electoral law that governs the rules of elections. It is a nationality law that governs the rights and responsibilities and procedures surrounding Lebanese nationality. Now, given that parliament is currently dominated by existing status quo political forces, and that the Speaker of Parliament has been the same person, Nabih Berri of the Amal movement, since 1992, there is no reason to suspect that whatever cabinet is formed, that the legislator, meaning the parliament, is going to pass any kind of substantive laws, even if we have the best cabinet in place. So this is why the idea is that you need a cabinet that is legislatively empowered, meaning a cabinet that has the authority to pass legislation that is at the level of law that would count just as much as if parliament had passed it. So this is the idea of legislative authority vested in a cabinet. And there are historical precedents for this happening. Now, on the other hand, you can't have successful and meaningful change in Lebanon, even if the cabinet has legislative authority, if the cabinet itself is beholden to the existing political parties who themselves dominate parliament. So this is why any way out, and here again, we're talking through the constitutional process, is going to require, 1, a cabinet empowered with legislative authority, but 2, that the composition of that cabinet be autonomous from the existing political parties, that they be women and men that are not beholden to political parties, or meaning the status quo political parties, but that actually share a vision of transforming Lebanese state, economy, and society. This cabinet, I and my colleagues argue, is the type of cabinet that could pass the new electoral law, that could pass the pending law for judicial reform and independence, that could pass a number of measures that could allow for the holding of elections and the establishment of new centers of political power within the Lebanese state, that then could collaborate, debate, and even disagree in certain ways on how to get Lebanon and the population of Lebanon out of the multiple and overlapping crises that they currently experience. There is no reason, once again, to suspect that the existing political parties will do anything to meaningfully exit Lebanon from the multiple and overlapping crises, because their priority is not the well-being of the Lebanese economy, not the well-being of the population that lives in Lebanon. Their priority is their political incumbency, and they would be willing to see the country burn, just like we've seen in many other parts of the world, before allowing their hold on power to be fundamentally threatened.
Shifting to some of the exogenous forces, on September 1st, French President Macron traveled to Lebanon for the second time since the August 4th devastating explosion. Al Jazeera has reported that ahead of his talks with the leaders and representatives of the traditional parties, the French embassy distributed a quote-unquote draft program to the heads of Lebanon's political blocs. We should add that the appointment of Mr. Adib came only hours before Mr. Macron's arrival on Monday and was reportedly forged under pressure from Mr. Macron, even though he rejected accusations that he personally chose Mr. Adib and made a deal with Iran, as it was reported. Can you talk about what is included in this French proposal and the significance of this move by the French government?
First, I think that we should point out is that September 1st, 2020 is the centennial for the declaration of the establishment of the State of Lebanon by a French colonial official 100 years ago. So it should not be lost on us the political and historical symbolism of Macron timing his visit for September 1st and trying to play the role of restructuring or somehow allowing for some new beginning in Lebanon. The French motivations and policies in this place should not be read as some type of benign liberal intervention, but this is Macron in particular and France more generally trying to position itself in the aftermath of the Beirut explosion amongst competitors like Turkey and others for influence in the southern and eastern Mediterranean ports and other access points for the Mediterranean Sea. It is also part of a rivalry within the European Union and between European and U.S. counterparts for establishing some kind of new relationship with Lebanon and perhaps even the Middle East. So I think that's really important to recognize. Now, whether Mr. Adib's selection as the premier was actually a request by Macron and part of some backdoor deal with Iran is not really clear to me. But whether that's true or not, what we have to understand is that French foreign policy has been part and parcel of the post-war order in Lebanon since 1990, let alone its history during the colonial period, the early independence period, and civil war. And France is just as culpable as any other party in the international community for the creation of this status quo. And the idea that it is going to lead any meaningful transition out of the existing status quo into something more accountable, more transparent, more just needs to be viewed with a great amount of skepticism. Macron's basic approach to the reforms that he is, it's not clear, asking for or demanding in Lebanon are basically in line with the set of reforms that have been advanced by the International Monetary Fund, the Friends of Lebanon donor group. He's not saying anything new in terms of those demands, but at the same time, I think we should be wary of looking at Macron or France as some kind of genuine, benign intervener that is going to benefit the people of Lebanon.
In the midst of all the agonizing events in Lebanon, there was a piece of good news last week when the World Bank said that it was canceling a loan for the Besri Dam project. The dam, which would be situated on a seismic fault line, had also been surrounded by allegations of corruption. Gebran Basile, the son-in-law of President Michel Aoun, and former energy minister push plans for the construction of some 14 dams, including the Besri Dam project. For years, environmentalists had been saying that Besri Dam would destroy a valley that is rich in biodiversity, and the activists had called for the project to be scrapped completely and for the site to be turned into a nature reserve. This may not be the best example, Ziad, but surely it reminds us that with or without President Macron, the one and only force that may bring about a truly new power structure is the Lebanese street and civil society at large. Do you think we'll see a resurgence of the massive protests that we witnessed during the October 17 uprising in order to change the power structure in the country?
Let me address the broader question about the reemergence of a mass uprising and then go back to the Bisri Dam project and its cancellation. I think predicting the emergence of a new mass uprising is very difficult to do, and there is a lot that goes into its emergence. We saw the attempt to reignite mass protests in the aftermath of the August 4th explosion. And while we saw large numbers of people take to the streets the Saturday after the explosion, those protests were largely centered in Beirut, and they did not have any afterlife, of course, in part because of the dramatic levels of state violence that was used to crush those protests. So I don't know if a mass uprising is going to emerge again. I think it's safe to say that for now, the mass uprising nature of protests has definitely fizzled out and was specifically targeted and dismantled by the political parties, in large part through the use of state institutions such as the army, the internal security forces, the civilian and military judicial systems. Now, with regards to the Bisri Dam, I think this is a really important example to show the significance and importance of a very organized and localized popular protest campaign that was able, in the aftermath of the existing and overlapping crises and the explosion, to really catalyze its history and its record in forcing concessions from the World Bank. In other words, I think had there not been a major popular protest campaign against the Bisri Dam, the World Bank would have probably simply proceeded with the Bisri Dam project. But given the fact that there was a major uprising, and given the fact that there is a debate, particularly after the August 4th explosion, of whether financial support will be forthcoming to Lebanon in the absence of any meaningful reform, it proved impossible for the World Bank to continue with that loan agreement, given the broader political context, but in particular because of the existence of a long-standing protest campaign. So this is one of those situations where it wasn't clear whether the Bisri Dam activists and campaign was going to be successful, but they were able to be successful in part because of changing broader political circumstances that only highlighted the stakes and efforts that they had put to work there. And they're very inspiring, and it's a rare but important victory for activists in Lebanon.
Ziad Abu Rish is co-director of MA program in Human Rights and the Arts and visiting associate professor of human rights at Bard College. He serves as co-editor of Arab Studies Journal and Jadalia. He is also a research fellow at the Lebanese Center for Policy Studies. He spoke with Shahram Aghami from Beirut, Lebanon. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. On August 11th, Iranian prominent human rights lawyer Nasrin Sotoudeh started her second hunger strike this year to protest the inhumane treatment of Iranian political prisoners amid the COVID-19 pandemic and release of all political prisoners in Iran. In her recent piece on the Atlantic Council website, Human Rights Watch Iran researcher Tara Sepehrifar writes, quote, "By putting their health at risk, Sotoudeh and others are trying to draw attention to the perilous situation of prisoners in Iran at a time when intensified U.S. sanctions and tensions with Iran, in addition to the coronavirus pandemic, have largely overshadowed the plight of people who shouldn't be in prison in the first place." In March 2019, the court sentenced Nasrin Sotoudeh in absentia to 38 years in prison and 148 lashes. I spoke with Tara about Nasrin Sotoudeh's hunger strike and the criminalization of peaceful protests in Iran.
My understanding is that Sotoudeh is determined to continue her strike, according to her husband, who has shared information on his social media account. Sotoudeh's husband, Reza Khandan, is also an activist, and he has been in prison for his own activism and supporting Nasrin's work. She has lost weight, and she has refused to receive medical care, but she wants to continue her strike to raise awareness about the situation of political prisoners in Iranian prison at the time of the global pandemic of COVID-19. Several other prisoners have also joined her, supporting her struggle and also her call to release political prisoners. And I think what is most important for us is to echo the demands of these people who are putting their health at risk to raise awareness about the situation and the injustice against them. Iranian authorities back in April announced that they had released about 100,000 prisoners on temporary furloughs or clemency orders that they issued over a period of about a month. But the number hasn't been verified independently because we don't have access to Iranian prisons to do this large-scale study. But if you look at the names of people who have been released and it's out there are very few human rights defenders and political prisoners who have been able to use this privilege of temporary releases, and dozens of well-known human rights defenders who have done nothing but peaceful dissent and activism who are still behind bars at the time that Iran is still struggling to control COVID-19. And as we all know, prisons are one of the most high-risk places because it's a place of confinement that social distancing is really impossible in many instances.
You brought up several points. First off, why haven't the Iranian authorities released political prisoners? Iran has been celebrated as being successful and forward-thinking in releasing more than 100,000 prisoners. Of course, as you mentioned, we're not really sure exactly how many prisoners and which prisons these prisoners have been released from.
I think the problem of overcrowdedness in Iranian prisons have been widely acknowledged by Iranian authorities. There are a combination of reasons why there's overcrowdedness in Iranian prison. One of them could be excessive use of imprisonment and criminalization of petty crimes. But when it comes to the situation of political prisoners and the decision to release them or not, I think we're not with an impartial and transparent assessment of the criteria needed for the release or reducing the population of prisons. I think then the calculation is really a political calculation that has been going on for decades about the situation of political prisoners in Iran. And we have a long history of authorities using rights that should be granted to prisoners, regardless of the nature of the quote-unquote crime they have committed, as additional pressure point. For instance, there's a long history of different human rights defenders and political prisoners being deprived of prompt access to adequate health care and them having to negotiate to receive proper health care outside prison. And I think this kind of follows the same pattern that even though the risks are higher, and if you want to look at it from purely reducing prison population perspective during a global health pandemic, political prisoners who have not committed any violent act, they've only been sentenced on speech crimes or activism crimes, they're probably the least dangerous people to be let out of prison, end up being behind bars because the perceived threat that they have against the establishment is higher because it's security apparatus that is making these decisions. We have the case of Narges Mohammadi, for example, who suffers from a neurological disease and is in the category of high-risk people. And she has been in prison in Zanjan, and there were reports of her contracting COVID-19 and her situation not being great. And then the authorities still refused to grant her a medical furlough, basically endangering her life. So I think the situation, it's very unfortunate, but it's hard not to conclude that the calculation that is going on is based on ensuring a tight grip on activism by these people and ensuring that they could control their activism more than what should be granted to them as their right. I mean, it's very important to state that these people should have not been in prison in the first place because they haven't committed any crime. But my point is that if you want to put yourself in authorities' shoes trying to reduce the prison population, these people should be the first to let go.
Well, she was convicted on 7 charges and sentenced to 38 years in prison and 148 lashes. She has to serve 12 years of this 38 years sentence. Is that correct?
That is my understanding, yes.
What's behind that 12-year number?
So under Iranian penal code, the crimes, if when they're from the same category, you only serve the longest prison sentence. And if it's above a certain number, you can serve the longest plus up to half of the longest prison sentence. So the intention of the article is to reduce the length of prison sentences for people in general, reducing imprisonment. But in practice, I think what we have seen in the past 6-7 years is that the length of prison sentences that activists are receiving has actually increased. So if, for example, during 2009, activists were receiving prison sentences between 2 to 5 or maximum 7 or 8 years, now many of the activists in prison are serving imprisonment above 10 years. So it is something that is in accordance with Iran's penal code. But I think, as I mentioned in my piece, what is striking about Sotoudeh's verdict is the extent authorities are criminalizing human rights activism. But the views as evidence of the crime Sotoudeh has committed is basically peaceful assembly in support of abolishing the death penalty step by step. It is a group that states very clearly that they want a gradual abolishment of the death penalty in Iran. They're not even radical enough to call for immediate abolishment. And still gathering with this group in front of the UN office in Tehran has been cited as assembly, as collusion against national security, or her interviews with foreign media or meeting with foreign politicians.
And one of the charges against her is for encouraging prostitution.
When the movement against compulsory hijab really gained popularity, I think authorities also looked for ways to prosecute people who were engaging in it, because the punishment and prescribing law for not properly covering your hair with the headscarf doesn't go beyond few months or maximum a year or two. What they've done in the case of some activists who took their headscarf off in public and advocated for a change of law, and Sotoudeh, who was very outspoken in their defense and wanted to represent, is that they have elevated the charge to basically public indecency and going against public morale and encouraging prostitution in order to basically increase the punishment for it, which, for example, that charge can carry 10 years in prison. And they're basically using the advocacy element that these people have in advocating peacefully for the law to change, to elevate the charge from a simple act of refusing to wear hijab to advocating for prostitution, which is shocking.
How many of the young women who protested the mandatory hijab are still in jail? Because I know a number of them left Iran.
At least five people are still in jail. Saba Kordafshani, and I think her mother, Yasemin Aryani, and Mojgan, I am blanking on her last name, but these three women and their mothers, especially Saba and Yasemin, are both very young, but very outspoken about their activism. And as you mentioned, some other activists who actually received shorter prison sentences in the beginning have left the country since. But there's still people who are in prison for their activism about this issue.
You spoke about how Iranian authorities have put pressure on political prisoners by different means. On August 18th, for example, Ms. Nasrin Sotoudeh's daughter, Mehraveh Khandan, was arbitrarily arrested by five security officers at her home in Tehran, transferred to the court in Evin. No reason was given for her arrest. However, she was later charged with physically assaulting a female security officer, and then she was released on bail. And this is according to one of the reports. Also, her husband was arrested and then later released, but his case is open. He appealed it and it's still ongoing. And in July of this year, her husband said that Iranian authorities had also barred access to their bank account. So what are they hoping to accomplish?
I mean, I think silencing activists and basically ensuring that they don't use their popularity with the society to mobilize has been a goal of the intelligence authorities, because if you look at the range of actions they employ, it can range from, for example, a simple summon or phone call, a threatening phone call, to summoning someone, to arresting, to prosecuting, to sentencing, and then not stopping at the point of punishing the person and extending the harassment to family. And this can even last after people are released from prison. Often, for example, journalists, when they're released from prison, they find out that they've lost their job or they've lost their pension. They can't really access it. So it's a campaign of harassment and pressure to convince you to give up or be silent in different ways. And if you don't give up, then the pressure increases. I think in the case of Sotoudeh, she has been particularly outspoken on many of these issues, and her family has always supported her, and that's why they are also being targeted. It's quite cool to target someone's daughter. Mehraveh is only 21 years old, and it was very striking observation by many activists when Mehraveh was arrested, because people did remember her photos of being a young child the first time Nasrin was arrested, for example, and was in prison in 2000. She was released in 2014. And now her daughter has grown up to a young woman, and she is still facing harassment because of her mother's activism. So the reality is that this suffering of human rights defenders is not only about the individual experience, but also about the family experience. In many cases, for example, when particularly men who are breadwinners of the family are taken away and their bank accounts are seized or just simply they can't work, the family as a whole struggles. But in the case of Sotoudé, as I said, because she's been particularly outspoken, you can identify these acts of harassment that is targeting the family and goes way beyond Sotoudé herself.
So when she was charged, she was tried in absentia, and then they arrested her in her house.
They arrested her in summer of 2018, and it wasn't very clear why they were arresting her. It was there new charges or she was serving a sentence that she wasn't sure about. And then they said that, yes, she had been tried in absentia. That's something they've used at least against another human rights defender, Narges Mohammadi. She was arrested after she met with Catherine Ashton, the former head of the EU foreign policy chief. They said that, oh, no, she has just the remainder of her prison sentence that she needs to serve. She was in detention. They brought new charges against her. It seems like for Sotoudé, I think there are at least two or three cases against her at different courts. They've all been combined. And that's why I think the strategy is to bring the maximum number of charges possible from all these avenues. Because if you actually look at the charges and the evidence used, many of them are illegal under Iranian law, because you can't be tried for a crime you've committed more than once. But they recycle many of these quote-unquote evidence to charge people with the maximum number to increase the length that they can keep people in prison. Sometimes it's easier to issue an arrest warrant if you have an outstanding sentence. And once you are in detention, then it's a lot easier to get permission for additional interrogation and additional case to be opened than maybe convincing a judge to issue an arrest warrant based on your old evidence.
This is the second time that she has decided to go on hunger strike. I think the first one was about 7 months ago. And there are other lawyers in prison at the moment. As you said, there are some political prisoners who started their own hunger strike in support of Nasrin Sotoudé and her demands for release of all political prisoners. Why do you think they're trying to make an example of Nasrin Sotoudé?
Nasrin has become a symbol for the Iranian civil society, particularly in the international scene. She was the person who was released when President Rouhani was visiting the UN General Assembly for the first time after his election. So I think they're aware of Nasrin's status internally and internationally, and the reach she might have in mobilizing some of these activities against them. Otherwise, there was absolutely no reason for them to arrest Sotoudé, who had said that she was going to represent people who had taken off their headscarf in protest. She wasn't joining the movement necessarily, but she was immediately arrested and she was handed down this extremely long prison sentence. I think for them, it's important to isolate individuals who have the ability to mobilize either internally or at the international level. At the time that the country seems to be in a dire economic situation and people seem very frustrated with the combination of political repression, perceived corruption, and economic situation.
Sotoudé was arrested in June of 2018. On March of 2019, she was sentenced to 38 years in prison. And before going on hunger strike, she wrote several letters to the judicial authorities concerning the poor conditions of political prisoners and also demanding the release of political prisoners because of COVID. And she wrote, many prisoners are currently eligible for conditional release and many of them will be freed with the enforcement of a new law. However, prisoners are being treated as if there is no such a law or legal resource, while the authorities refuse to respond to any communications requesting legal steps for prisoners' release. And then she ends by saying, given the lack of any response to communications and requests for the freedom of political prisoners, I am starting a hunger strike. Now, it's been a month, and her case has gradually been getting international attention. She has been given several awards, international lawyer organizations, Pan America, they have all written letters in her support and calling for her release. What's been the reaction of the Iranian authorities?
I mean, I think so far the authorities have disregarded the attention, and it might be because of all other crises that have been happening in the country. For example, several campaigns of not executing people who have received death sentences in connection to their participation in the protest or alleged murder of security officers during the protest, and they've been busy defending the system's action on those fronts. And usually authorities, I think, often respond to a combination of domestic and international pressure, because particularly the new head of the judiciary, who actually has a very dark past and was quite influential during the mass executions of political prisoners in the 80s, has been responsive to some of the popular protests, particularly in the online space in certain cases, but only when the pressure is felt also at home. And I think the reason that the attention might have not been focused on this particular issue is because there are several other things that are going on. And Nasrin is only one of the dozens of activists who are behind bars right now. There have been some other urgent issues that civil society attention might have been divided on them as well. But I think usually when the international pressure is in coordination with the domestic concern, there is a reaction from authorities. And in some cases, the reaction has been positive. I am unfortunately pessimistic that the demand of releasing all political prisoners would be achieved immediately. But I think there are many ways for authorities to implement existing laws to release people who should not have been in prison in the first place, as Nasrin pointed out in her letter.
Tara Seperifar is a researcher for Human Rights Watch, where she investigates human rights abuses in Iran and Kuwait. You can read Tara Seperifar's article, Why Nasrin Sotoudeh is on Hunger Strike to Protest Iran's Dire Prison Conditions, on the Atlantic Council website. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
You can find us on Twitter at @Bomina_radio, or listen to our past shows on iTunes or SoundCloud at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can also reach us by email at bominaradio@gmail.com. Please join us next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and thank you for listening.
If you made a compensation claim for abuse at an Indian residential school, the records of your claim are secure. They will be destroyed in September 2027 unless you choose to keep them or share them. To learn more, call toll-free 1-877-635-2648 or go to myrecordsmychoice.ca.
COVID-19 pandemic in Canada is serious. We must continue to practice all public health measures. Follow local guidelines for gatherings, maintain physical distancing, wash your hands, wear a mask, and download the COVID Alert app. If you have symptoms, even mild ones, stay home. Protect yourself and others. Learn more at canada.ca/coronavirus or 1-833-784-4397. A message from the Government of Canada.
Widget of my man Pro V.
All the way live from university.
Damn, Montreal.
On CKUT.
Nobody doing better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone. CKUT in the place to be from the bottom to the TOP.
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the way live radio, CKUT 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Big shout out to Widget, shout out to CKUT. Today is going to be an all Rock Marciano show, 2 hours of Rock Marciano. He just dropped a new album, so I decided I'm going to put together everything, all the features, the collabos,